From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. The best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, a growing number of lawmakers and economists argue the single biggest cause of the financial collapse was the repeal of an obscure Depression-era law back in 1999. It's called Glass-Steagall, and some people want to bring it back.
It's not going to work to let the biggest financial institutions just go out and do what they want.
But would it have prevented the J.P. Morgan debacle?
I think this has been wildly exaggerated. This is not something that taxpayers ought to be worried about.
Also, the story behind a mysterious pediatric disease that might be able to tell us how human pathogens are spread. The movie that Academy Award-winning screenwriter Dustin Lance Black could watch a million times, and then we have a winner. Our newest three-minute fiction winner joins us. Plus, singer John Mayer returns from exile 2 years after saying very stupid things.
I just remember thinking to myself, like, well, this is Playboy. I don't want anybody at Playboy to be like, this is a boring interview. I want to give him stuff.
And later, he captured the heart of American Idol fans and then became an inadvertent icon.
I really feel like I can't win one way or another. Either I'm not gay enough or I'm too gay.
Singer Adam Lambert stops by to talk about his new record. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. All right, to our cover story now, and the question we're asking today is, in light of the $2 billion-plus trading loss by J.P. Morgan Chase last week, whatever happened to financial reform, and more importantly, could it have prevented that loss? And even more importantly, should any of us really care if J.P. Morgan lost all that cash?
Senator, come to order.
Our story begins on November 4th, 1999.
Today, the Senate will resume consideration of the conference report to accompany the Financial Services Modernization Bill.
It sounds a bit dull, but what was being discussed that day was quite possibly the most profound change to the U.S. financial system in 66 years.
There are approximately 6 hours of debate remaining under the order.
President Bill Clinton and his Treasury Secretary Larry Summers urged Congress to ease Depression-era regulations that separated commercial banks and investment banks. The law was known as Glass-Steagall, and Congress passed it in 1933 in the midst of the Great Depression. The original intent was to prevent the kind of speculation and bank runs that led to the catastrophic stock market crash in 1929. But by 1999, the overwhelming consensus on Capitol Hill was it was time for a change.
Mr. President, this is a historic moment.
That's New York Senator Chuck Schumer. That day, November 4th, 1999, speaker after speaker rose on the Senate floor to call for the repeal of Glass-Steagall.
If we didn't pass this bill, we could find London or Frankfurt or years down the road, Shanghai becoming the financial capital of the world.
Nebraska Senator Bob Kerry dismissed the tiny minority of senators who criticized the bill.
I think the concerns that we're going to have a meltdown like we had in 1929 is our concerns that are dramatically overblown. Given
just eight senators voted against repeal. Republican Richard Shelby was one of them. So was
Mr. President,
North Dakota Democrat Byron Dorgan.
I come to the floor to say that I regret that I cannot support the legislation.
Byron Dorgan is no longer a senator, but back at the time, Dorgan recalls, there was immense pressure to back repeal. Were you seen as a kind of an oddball for opposing this at the time?
Well, I don't know if they saw me as an oddball, but I was sure a pain in the side because I went down to the floor again and again and again to speak against this. I said, this is going to fuel consolidation and mergers on Wall Street.
Substantial new concentration and mergers in the financial services industry.
It's going to raise the likelihood of future massive taxpayer bailouts.
And we are deliberately and certainly with this legislation moving towards inheriting much greater risk in our financial services industries.
I said, I think we're going to look back.
We will in 10 years' time look back and say we should not have done that because we forgot the lessons of the past.
I was, very concerned about what this was going to mean to the future of the country.
Now, why dig up an old story about something that happened on the Senate floor more than a decade ago? Well, the answer is because there's a small but increasingly vocal group of lawmakers, including Senator John McCain, who want to reinstate Glass-Steagall. Many of them argue that that decision, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, was so consequential, so important, that there's a direct link between it and the financial meltdown of 2008, and more recently, the $2 billion-plus trading loss by J.P. Morgan Chase last week.
Today, the Justice Department launched a criminal probe into J.P. Morgan's $2 billion trading loss.
Boy, this was a real bomb that dropped on the street.
Analysts are grilling CEO Jamie Dimon.
J.P. Morgan down almost 7% in after hours on egregious trading losses of $2 billion.
Now, the connection between Glass-Steagall and the loss at J.P. Morgan Chase is by no means definitive. And later, we'll hear from a former Reagan official who says any attempt to make that connection is nonsense. But first, to someone who has vowed, if elected to the U.S. Senate, to bring Glass-Steagall back. Her name is Elizabeth Warren. She's a Harvard Law professor and the architect of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That was created as part of a series of financial reforms passed in 2010 known as Dodd-Frank. We'll get to that in a few moments. Elizabeth Warren is now running for the U.S. Senate from Massachusetts, and she's a lightning rod for opponents of tougher financial regulation. When I spoke with her this week, the first question I asked, why should any of us care whether J.P. Morgan Chase lost its shirt on a bad bet? After all, the CEO of the company, Jamie Dimon, isn't asking for a taxpayer bailout.
Because he's not asking this time. But the point is, he's taking on those risks. And look, this isn't personal to Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan Chase. This is really about the large financial institutions saying it's business as usual. We will make the decisions how much risk we want to take on. We'll figure out the gambles. We'll juice our bottom line profits by just betting some extraordinary sums of money. And we don't want the regulators to have anything to do with it. But what we all learned in 2008 is when they get that, they may get all the profits in the good times, but when they get it wrong, it's the taxpayers, it's everybody else who comes in and has to pick up the pieces. And that means the deal doesn't work. If they want to be in the banking business, they have to be willing to submit to effective regulation.
You have recently announced that you would want to reinstate the Glass-Steagall bill, that you would want to reintroduce this bill that was repealed in 1999. How would reintroducing that have prevented what happened with J.P. Morgan last week?
Well, the key on Glass-Steagall is that it makes banking boring. It says if you want to do all those exciting things like take $100 billion bets or lose $2 billion or maybe three, you need to do that over in the Wall Street trading kind of business, not in a basic commercial bank that takes deposits and, you know, checking accounts and savings accounts. Glass-Steagall says there needs to be a wall between those two kinds of activities. Congress, I hope, sees the writing here and says it's not going to work to let the biggest financial institutions just go out and do what they want. We can't turn these guys loose.
My understanding was that the so-called Volcker Rule, named after Paul Volcker, the former Fed chairman, was supposed to address this, that this is part of the Dodd-Frank financial reform that was passed 2 years ago. Why not just work on strengthening that?
Well, and that is an approach. Look, I supported the Volcker Rule. But remember what the heart of the Volcker Rule is about. It says, these biggest financial institutions can continue to engage in both kinds of activities. That is, the boring taking deposits and all that sort of thing. At the same time that they're also doing the high-risk activities, so long as we keep careful watch over them. If that's not working, if we don't have regulators who are able to be strong enough, who can write tough enough rules to keep that distinction in place, the Volcker Rule won't be able to do its job.
That's Elizabeth Warren. She's a candidate for U.S. Senate from Massachusetts. By the way, her opponent in the race, Senator Scott Brown, was one of just three Republicans who backed the financial reform bill known as Dodd-Frank back in 2010. In a moment, Dodd-Frank was supposed to tighten the screws on Wall Street, but many of its provisions have been held up in legal limbo. We'll find out why next, and later, an update from the G8 summit and an interview with singer John Mayer you won't want to miss. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Back in 2010, when Congress passed what's become known as Dodd-Frank, the president hailed it as a turning point.
So all told, these reforms represent the strongest consumer financial protections in history.
Dodd-Frank was supposed to do things like prevent predatory lending, ban big banks from taking risky bets with taxpayer money, and limit speculators from inflating prices of commodities. Some of that is happening, but according to an article in the latest issue of Rolling Stone, Wall Street has been mounting a massive campaign to roll back key parts of the law. Reporter Matt Taibbi wrote that story.
The easiest way to see that is in the issue that most directly bears upon this Chase incident, which is the whole issue surrounding the Volcker Rule. Now, the Volcker Rule was designed to prevent what they call proprietary trading, which is a bank trading for its own account. But before the Volcker Rule was even passed in the original version of Dodd-Frank, industry insisted on a wave of exemptions and loopholes. And there were so many, basically anything could be exempted under the rule, including this particular trade that got Chase in trouble. Beyond that, the Volcker Rule took so long to write because they had to craft all these very, very careful and detailed exemptions. Now the Volcker Rule is not going to go into effect until 2014. If it does, which I have serious doubts, I think there'll be a lawsuit, there'll be new legislation, something will happen, and we'll just never get that rule.
And there are all of these banks that are basically taking parts of Dodd-Frank and challenging it in court, right?
Yes, and that's happening across the board with all different parts of the bill. You know, we've had a lot of volatility with commodities, things like oil and food prices, and a lot of this is because there's been this huge influx of speculative money that's poured into these markets. And Dodd-Frank theoretically addressed this by saying essentially that no one speculator could dominate more than a quarter of the market at any time. Well, industry filed a lawsuit which challenged the legality of that rule on the basis that the government did not perform a cost-benefit analysis of the law. And so that's being tied up in the courts now, and my guess is that that'll be overturned.
You described a situation where you have a lot of critics saying, look at these financial regulations, 17,000 pages of this Dodd-Frank law, but they're also the same people, you argue, who created these 17,000 pages by lobbying for them.
That's absolutely the case. I think if the proponents of Dodd-Frank had had their way, just like what FDR did, you would have had just a couple of simple but very hard rules. For instance, you can't be too big to fail. There was a lot of movement to pass a law that said that if a bank got to be a certain size, that it just had to be broken up. But they managed to overturn that. Originally, they were going to create an FDIC-style fund the banks would pay into ahead of time to pay for future bailouts. But that was defeated. And what they created instead was this incredibly convoluted process by which the state would put up the money for bailouts first, and then would have to recoup the money from Wall Street later over the course of a process that could take 10 years or more. So this is kind of an example of how Dodd-Frank worked in general. You started off with a very simple concept, and by the time industry was done with it, it was 1,000 pages long every time.
That's Rolling Stone magazine's Matt Taibbi. Peter Wallison was the general counsel for the Treasury Department under President Ronald Reagan. He believes Dodd-Frank is a bad law that imposes layers of unnecessary bureaucracy on the financial system. And he also argues that proponents of regulation are just trying to take advantage of the J.P. Morgan trading loss to push for more regulation.
I think this has been wildly exaggerated. This is not something that taxpayers ought to be worried about. The bank will earn probably this year somewhere between $15 and $20 billion. So again, $2 billion hurts the shareholders, but it doesn't do very much to damage the position of the bank or its health. So the one thing that I think might have changed the way this has developed would have been to educate members of the media who took a $2 billion loss on a $2 trillion bank and treated it as though it was some kind of indication that banks are not being properly managed.
I mean, there are two separate narratives here. And one narrative says 1999, Glass-Steagall was repealed, and there's a direct link between what happened then and what happened in 2008. There's another narrative that says that's just not the case. 2008 would have happened anyway. It had nothing to do with that.
Yeah, well, look, even if we give credit to the narrative that says that what happened in 2008 was the result of lack of regulation of the banks, there really is no connection between Glass-Steagall at all and what happened with the banks, because the banks made bad loans in 2008. They have always been permitted to make loans. Glass-Steagall had nothing to do with whether they make loans. That's what banks are supposed to be doing. And the fact that they were able to affiliate with firms that underwrote or dealt in securities makes no difference at all.
Let me go back to J.P. Morgan for a moment, because the market value of the company initially fell by $15 billion or so. It's still way off what it was before. What do you think other banks will take out of that episode? I mean, do you think they will become less likely to take chances that could lead to profits?
You know, most of what has been said about this is that it was a trade for the purpose of earning profits. This was a trade or a series of trades that were intended to protect the bank against losses. Now, any trade that is a hedge is potentially a loss. That only means that banking and any kind of financial activity of the kind that banks do is always going to be somewhat risky. Will this keep other banks from hedging their assets? One would hope not. That would probably contribute substantially to additional losses. So I think the only thing that it might do is to make sure that every complicated trade is gone over by many more people and followed much more carefully than this one was.
That's Peter Wallison, a former Treasury official in the Reagan administration. By the way, last month, under industry pressure, the SEC agreed to exempt thousands of Wall Street firms from oversight on derivatives trading if they earn less than $8 billion a year. By one estimate, that could affect up to 85% of financial firms. To another story about scientific research, also inconclusive and very much theoretical, but if proved true, could revolutionize our understanding of how human pathogens are spread. First, to the mysterious disease in question.
So, Mother's Day last year, my son, who was 4 at the time, woke up with kind of a rash and a fever.
At first, Deborah Kogan figured it would pass. But as the hours ticked by, her son Leo's fever became worse. So she took him to the pediatrician, who figured it was strep.
The next day, he woke up and he was puffy. Not really puffy, but slightly puffy. And it sort of looked like he had the mumps.
The strep test result was negative, but by Tuesday morning,
he looked as if he were one of the characters on The Nutty Professor. His face had ballooned to about twice its normal size.
Deborah called up her doctor, made an appointment, but in the meantime, she posted photos of Leo onto her Facebook page, and a crowdsourced diagnosis began to take shape.
Within 10 minutes of posting that photo, a friend of mine called me on the phone. She said,
"Look." She told Deborah to take Leo to the hospital immediately, and then the flood of Facebook posts began. Her cousin Emily wrote,
"Look, I really think you should check and make sure it's not Kawasaki disease. I hope the doctors have ruled out Kawasaki disease.
On
symptoms
and on
of Kawasaki disease." Within an hour, I was hearing the word Kawasaki disease. I'd never heard of it before.
Deborah never bothered going back to the doctor's office.
I picked up my kid. I ran to the hospital nearest us. We live in Harlem, so I went up to 165th to the Columbia Presbyterian Children's Hospital with an excellent rheumatology department.
Kawasaki disease was first identified by a Japanese pediatrician, Tomisaku Kawasaki, in 1967. It's not contagious, and it's still not clear how it spreads. It mainly affects children under the age of 4.
It wasn't until 1970 when the Japanese Ministry of Health did an inquiry.
That's Jane Byrne. She's a foremost expert on Kawasaki disease based at the University of California at San Diego.
They realized that there were children dying following this disease, and they were dying from heart attacks,
which in children is extremely rare. In the U.S., about 4,500 children are infected with the disease each year. And a few years ago, Jane Byrne started to notice a pattern, a seasonality to the cases she was diagnosing.
That meant that in January, February, March, we were going to be very busy. And then in September and October, we knew that that was a good time to take our vacation.
Japanese researchers noticed a similar pattern. So together, they worked with a group of climate scientists who started to analyze atmospheric data.
What the climate scientists found when they began sifting through all of the satellite data and the atmospheric data, these are things like temperature, precipitation, surface ocean temperature. What leapt out of the computer at them was an association with the direction of the wind circulating in the troposphere, so these are heights of 3,000 meters, and that these large-scale wind currents blew in one direction across Japan, then across the Pacific Ocean to Hawaii and the west coast of the U.S. when the cases were increased, and it blew in the opposite direction when there was a fall in the number of cases.
The data was so overwhelming that Burns and her team thought it couldn't be coincidental. Kawasaki is far more common in Asia than it is in the U.S. In Japan, for example, one out of every 150 kids is infected. So with this new data, Burns published a controversial theory last November in the journal Scientific Reports. She suggested that the disease may be carried by wind currents across the ocean inside tiny dust particles. If that theory is true, it could open up a whole new understanding into how other human pathogens are spread. No human disease has ever been shown to cross an ocean by wind and still remain infectious. In Deborah Kogan's case, the doctor examining her son Leo wasn't sure whether it was indeed Kawasaki disease.
She just said, look, we're going to treat him for Kawasaki disease because he's really sick, and hopefully by tomorrow he'll be better.
Leo did recover fairly quickly after being pumped with a blood product made up of antibodies, but it was terrifying.
I don't think I've been traumatized by anything as much as I was traumatized by having a child with Kawasaki disease. The big question mark hanging in the air for so long, the hours and hours it took to figure out what was wrong with him. Kawasaki disease is so rare that most doctors have never seen it. I think that's what is extremely difficult about having a kid with Kawasaki disease before the diagnosis, is just the not knowing.
Leo is now a healthy 5-year-old, and while Kawasaki disease is still rare, the number of cases both in the U.S. and in Japan have been rising steadily each year. It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. We've been asking filmmakers, actors and writers and directors about the movies that have changed their lives, the ones they watch over and over and over again, including this one from the Oscar award-winning writer of the movie Milk.
My name is Dustin Lance Black, and I'm a screenwriter, director, and the film that I've seen a million times is When Harry Met Sally with Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal, and directed by Rob Reiner. I probably saw When Harry Met Sally for the first time in college, so I was aligned right with the first scene of the movie.
Oh, hi, Sally. Sally, this is Harry Burns. Harry, this is Sally Albright.
Nice to meet you.
You meet these two characters. They're wrapping up their college years and going to move to New York.
Why don't you tell me the story of your life?
The story of my life?
We've got 18 hours to kill before we hit New York.
The story of my life isn't even going to get us out of Chicago. I mean, nothing's happened to me yet. That's why I'm going to New York.
You start to skip decades, or half decades at least.
Staying over?
Yes.
Would you like to have dinner? Just friends.
I thought you didn't believe men and women could be friends.
When did I say that?
On the ride to New York.
No, I never said this.
And you keep catching up with them,
yes,
as they run into
That's
each
right.
other and they move from two people who don't seem to like each other at all, even though we as an audience know differently.
Would you like to have dinner with me sometime?
Are we becoming friends now?
Yeah.
Great. A woman friend. You know, you may be the first attractive woman I have not wanted to sleep with in my entire life.
That's wonderful, Harry.
As happens with many single friends who become very intimate, they end up having sex, and then they have to backtrack from there, and then finally, they both realize at the same moment.
I've been doing a lot of thinking, and the thing is, I love you.
What?
I love you.
How do you expect me to respond to this?
How about you love me too?
Here's the thing with When Harry Met Sally, it doesn't matter how many times you watch it, it's always interesting, and you're always identifying with a different scene in the movie. At least I am. And the hope is that you're always progressing to a later and later scene in the film, so that one day you may get to the end and you may be running through Manhattan on New Year's Eve to kiss the person you truly love, and you know you love them, and they love you in return, and you're aiming for that. And if this movie is on TV or on pay-per-view or on an airplane recently, I saw it again, I always check in to see how I'm progressing. And unfortunately, it seems I'm always returning to the Carrie Fisher Rolodex scene in the movie where you're looking for somebody new.
I've got the perfect guy. I don't happen to find him attractive, but you might. She doesn't have a problem with chins.
Who is it?
Alex Anderson.
Oh.
You fixed me up with him 6 years ago. I'm sorry.
Far too often I find myself in that position, and you're just screaming inside saying, no, 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 it's not about that. There's something more magical than a Rolodex in the park, and you find yourself in tears.
Oh, wait. Look, I got one.
There is no point in my going out with someone I might really like if I met him at the right time, but who right now has no chance of being anything to me but a transitional man.
Okay, but don't wait too long.
Is it speaking to such basic truths about matchmaking and love that I think it's withstood the test of time?
It had to be you. It had to be you.
That's writer Dustin Lance Black talking about the movie that he could watch a million times, When Harry Met Sally. He won an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay for Milk. Black's new film, Virginia, which he also directed, is in theaters now. And if you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. We finally made it. The end of round 8 of our 3-Minute Fiction contest has arrived. 3-Minute Fiction, of course, is our contest where we ask you to come up with an original short story that can be read in about 3 minutes. And with help from our readers at the Iowa Writers Workshop at NYU, the University of Oregon, and the University of Texas at Austin, we've read through over 6,000 stories we received this round. Our judge for this round, the novelist Luis Alberto Urrea, who's the author of Queen of America, has now picked his favorite. And in case you forgot, the challenge this round was that each story had to begin with a sentence. She closed the book, placed it on the table, and finally decided to walk through the door. And joining me now from WBEZ in Chicago is Luis himself. It's great to have you back.
Buenos dias, Guy.
Before we get to that winner, I know that you had a tough time because you had to pick one story out of 6,000 submissions. You obviously could not read all of them, but you read a lot of those stories. And you had some other favorites as well. So first talk about some of those favorites before we get to the winner.
I loved Mona Lisa. I loved Outliers, like characters in a book. It was a really moving story. Last Night, Pilgrims, The First Table, another deeply moving story. No Way Back, Overdue. I was amazed at how many of the stories ended up dealing with loss.
All those stories you just mentioned are actually posted at the website, npr.org/3-minute-fiction. So anyone listening who wants to check them out should do so. They are amazing stories. Luis, normally I would just keep chatting and then I would just drive people crazy. I actually got a phone call from somebody who submitted a story. I called her back because she wanted to know when we were going to announce a winner. And so I'm sure she's listening, Patty Chavez out in St. Louis. So, Patty, the winner is going to be announced right now. Luis?
All right, America. Our winner is Carrie McKillop with Rainy Wedding.
Tell us what it was about the story that drew you to it.
You know, sometimes you read a piece of literature that you realize you will never forget.
Well, one of my favorite parts of the winner's announcement is when we have Susan Stamberg read the entire story, and we have that. Let's take a listen.
She closed the book, placed it on the table, and finally decided to walk through the door. Her son lay dying on the other side, his blue pale skin in stark contrast to the bright red blanket on his bed. His gray eyes looked at her dully as she entered the room. She withheld the tears that wanted to come every moment and smiled cheerfully. "Today I get married, right?" he said with a smile. "Yes, sweetheart, today you get married." When the boy became ill and had to miss his first day of kindergarten, he had asked what school would be like. She started a ritual that day, explaining to him in detail everything he was missing, so that he and she could experience the life he would never have. In the last few months, lying in this bed, in this room, he had gone through every grade, graduated from high school, went to college and graduate school, and gotten a job as an architect. He met his fiancée when she lost her purse on a rainy day while he was at a meeting in Manhattan. She told him of a fairy tale romance, the day he had asked for her hand in marriage, the house they were planning to build. "What's the weather like today? Is it sunny?" Her son, though only 5, had lived 30 years in this bed. He worried that the caterer would be late, that his tuxedo wouldn't fit, that his Uncle Charlie would embarrass him in front of his new wife. No, it's really cloudy. There's a good chance of rain around 4. But that's when the ceremony is, he wailed. What are we going to do? It doesn't matter. It will be beautiful no matter what. She told how the bride's father had built a floor under the tent that morning to stave off the 2 feet of water that had developed in the backyard after 4 weeks of steady rain. She told how the maid of honor had stopped on the way back from getting her hair done to buy mud boots for the wedding party. How this was the rainiest spring on record. How it rained during the whole ceremony, drowning out the father of the groom when he read from the Bible. And how his new wife, looking as stunning as ever, had her best friend cut off her dress at the knee in the middle of the reception because it had soaked up so much mud and water. She's awesome, isn't she? He said gleefully. I'm really lucky, aren't I, Mom? She stroked his hair, taking in the small, thin features of his face, thinking of the life she and her husband had laid out for him before he was sick. All the world their little man would devour. You are so lucky, sweetheart. And so is she. As he eased into sleep, she thought about what the next few days would hold. She knew she didn't have much time to get him to his first child and that child's first day of school. She knew what he would ask when the baby was born. Will he get sick, Mommy? Of course she would answer no.
That is NPR's Susan Stamberg reading the winning story of this round of 3-Minute Fiction. It's called Rainy Wedding by Carrie McKillop, and Carrie joins us now from her local public radio station, WVPS, in Colchester, Vermont. Carrie, congratulations to you.
Thank you so much.
Luis is with us as well.
Hi, Luis.
Hi, Carrie.
Carrie, this story is so beautifully written. It is so heartbreaking. Tell me about this story. How did you come up with it?
For me, when I heard the prompt, it was so easy for me to picture the most difficult thing on the other side of the door, which would be a sick child. And I think the story just flowed from there.
I read it on paper, and Luis, I know you did several times, but to hear Susan read it, it's just so powerful. How did you respond, Luis, when you read Carrie's story?
I remember saying, and I'm going to tell you this, Carrie, right now, if you write like that all the time, you are America's next famous author because it's just devastating. I mean, listen to poor guy.
As a father of a young child, it's even probably more profoundly powerful to hear that story. Carrie, I want to move away from the sadness for a moment because this is a joyous moment. You have won the 3-Minute Fiction contest. First of all, do you have any background in creative writing?
No, I have a bachelor's degree in English from UCLA, but I was never accepted into the creative writing program, even though I tried really hard to get in.
I bet they have regrets now, don't you think, Luis?
Yeah, she was too good for an MFA, man.
Carrie, do you have any questions for Luis?
Honestly, I'm really curious why. I'm really excited, but I'm wondering what stood out. Was it the emotion that it evoked?
Well, there were a lot of layers of story. The way the story was told, I really loved it that there was no, bam, here's a snappy ending for you. It felt almost novelistic in its heft. Do not stop writing. Send me your work.
All right.
We'll keep
in
touch.
So
we'll be pen pals.
We'll hook you up with Luis offline. All right, Carrie?
Okay, super.
That's Carrie McKillop. She's the winner of round 8 of our 3-Minute Fiction contest with her story, Rainy Wedding. You can read Carrie's story and many, many others at our series webpage. It's npr.org/3-Minute Fiction. 3-Minute Fiction is all spelled out. Carrie, thank you so much for participating. Congratulations. It's such an amazing, amazing story.
Thank you so much.
And of course, to you, Luis, thank you so much for being our judge this round. You did literally read hundreds of stories. Carrie will receive a signed copy of his latest book, Queen of America. Luis is also the author of The Devil's Highway and The Hummingbird's Daughter. Luis, it has been an absolute pleasure having you as our judge.
Thank you, Guy.
And keep close to your radios. We're going to be back with 3-Minute Fiction in the fall, round 9. So stay tuned, and you will hear that here on Weekends and All Things Considered. It's time now for music, and a man whose disastrous choice of words sent him underground for the past 2 years. So we keep on waiting on the world to change. John Mayer was one of the biggest selling artists of the past decade, and with love interests like Jessica Simpson and Jennifer Aniston, he was relentlessly pursued by the paparazzi. Then in 2010, he gave a pair of interviews to Rolling Stone and to Playboy that shocked readers with sexually aggressive and racially insensitive language. John Mayer was self-destructing in full view of his fans. The blowback was intense, and Mayer pulled way back from the spotlight, rejecting almost every interview request. But John Mayer's starting to come out of his shell just a bit. He's promoting his first album since the controversy. It's a softer and more introspective collection called Born and Raised.
Then all at once it gets hard to take, it gets hard to fake what I won't be.
John Mayer has dealt with other problems, too. Last year, he developed a non-cancerous nodule near his vocal cords called a granuloma. It required surgery and a grueling recovery process. A few months ago, the granuloma returned, and it's caused him to cancel his upcoming tour and start all over again.
I'm not in recovery at the moment. I've actually just in a holding pattern until I can get the wherewithal, the discipline back again, the endurance to go through a six-month period of extreme self-discipline.
Which means because, what? No talking or nothing talking?
Well, there's no talking for the first month, probably.
Wow.
And then there's whispering. But really what this has to do with is diet. Basically, if you made a list of all the things that you enjoy eating or drinking, it's not – you can't do those things.
You should do your recovery in a Tibetan monastery.
Doctors have said you just live like a monk.
Yeah.
Because I've done it once before.
Yeah, you've had this surgery before.
We did the whole thing, and I say it's sort of like doing a cross-country trip from New York to L.A., getting to L.A. and realizing you forgot something in New York and getting back in the car and driving to go get it. You know, you may want to spend
I'm
a couple nights in
Los
Angeles.
I'm sorry to be laughing about this because it sounds miserable.
No, it's not. The problem is if I were to decide it were miserable, then my sentence would be being miserable for the next 8 months.
Yeah.
So what I have to do as an artist and as a person, but I think I have the ability as an artist, is to just sort of repurpose this so that it's not purgatory.
How does it sort of affect you when you sing? I mean, when you were recording this record, Born and Raised, did you suspect anything while you were in the studio? Did you sort of suddenly think something's wrong?
Oh, yeah. No, I knew it was wrong because I'd gone to a doctor back in April and saw this thing on the scope. But I also, the way that I wrote this record was by singing. I didn't sit down and compose this on a piece of paper. This was composed, you know, into a microphone.
You're saying that you didn't sit down and with pen and pad and write the lyrics down?
No. This record was all about, like, sort of improv. And so I would, like, enter this kind of trance. I know it sounds a little bit highfalutin, but I would enter this sort of trance, and sometimes it'd be an hour, sometimes it'd be 90 minutes, and you know, for every song on this record, I remember the moment I went, oh, let's chase this, you know. And then you begin to sort of work on that one project. One of the strongest ones I remember, or the strongest memories I have of stumbling on something, was playing the chords to Shadow, what would become the chorus to Shadow Days, and singing, I'm a good man with a good heart, and going, oh, that's stirring in one way or another. And then I remember thinking, well, if you're going to say that you're a good man with a good heart, you better explain why you think that. And you better explain that honestly. And so then I went, okay, well, I think I know what these verses have to be.
Did you know that you could be wrong and swear you're right? Some people been known to do it all their lives. But you find yourself alone just like you found yourself before. Like I found myself in pieces on the hotel floor. Hard times have helped me see. I'm a good man with a good heart. Had a tough time, got a rough start. But I finally learned to let it go.
I think the record's conversational that way because it's not as much of a thought out me penning a song on a piece of paper. It's me talking into a microphone. It's expressing myself at that moment.
I'm speaking with the singer and songwriter John Mayer. His new record is called Born and Raised. I want to ask you about lyrics because this is such an introspective record. I mean, it's hard not to hear the lyrics on some of these songs. Well, I ain't no troublemaker and I never meant her harm, or, you know, if I ever get around to living, when are you going to wise up, boy? It's hard not to hear those lyrics and think, man, John Mayer, this is a confessional. This is a record about something that you have been through and you're going through and you're working through.
Well, I had nowhere else to go, really, but to get more real, you know? I couldn't get any less genuine. And I don't know what it was. I do know what it is now because I've spent so long breaking it down. Part of it was like this like 7-year itch in a relationship with doing what I do for a living. I must have gotten bored or something. I don't know. I mean, I
And so what did you do?
Anything I wanted to. That's the problem. That's the problem. I think the salient problem was that I saw anything I wanted to do as a road worth taking, as if like I was this exception to every rule.
Whether it was destructive or not.
Yeah.
And I guess I should clarify for people who don't know what you're talking about. These are interviews you did with Playboy and Rolling Stone a few years ago where you made some sexually explicit remarks. I'm not going to go into detail. It's not worth
it. Yeah, I mean, I can actually talk about it now from a vantage point of like being out of it. I mean, I remember what it felt like. I'll never forget what it felt like. But I don't embody the feeling that much anymore because I just autopsied it so long. And, you know, and so for me, I remember going like, well, I really want to do comedy. Well, should I be able to do comedy? Probably not. Like, if I had just been a dude off the street saying, I want to do stand-up comedy, I don't think I would have been let on the stage. Or not on that whatever stage I went on. I would have had to beat a Radisson or something, you know? And so for me, it took me 2 years of breaking down what this all was to realize here's an opportunity that Rolling Stone or Playboy or whatever outlet is giving me to talk about my music. And I'm using this outlet to bomb at the Radisson. So I never would have been on the cover of Rolling Stone if someone had seen me do 8 minutes on stage. But I was so confused as to why people were interested in what I had to say. Why even some people, not even all people. I got those lines so crossed. And so when it came time to do these interviews where I had nothing to say, but I didn't want to be boring. I got in the worst trouble ever over and over again in my life from the time I was 4 till 2 years ago because I didn't want to be boring. And I remember thinking to myself, well, this is Rolling Stone. We got to give a Rolling Stone interview. And that's the miscalculation because the only thing you have to do is be honest. But I wasn't prepared to be honest, but I knew that I had to be open. When you're like just open because you think you need to be but not honest, then you start sort of free associating garbage. You know what I mean?
I mean, it sounds like in a sort of a weird way, what happened with those experiences was probably really important for you, like a wake-up call that you needed.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, you needed that.
It's something that happens to control freaks. When you think you're a mastermind and you think that you can correct your way out of anything, you will eventually learn that you cannot just correct your way out of everything. When you forget that the only reason people want to know your name is because of the music that you make that sometimes they want to hear. Some people don't like my music. What I was doing was thinking like, if they don't like me, then there must be something they're missing. I'm going to do something for this guy so he says, actually, ha, 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 turns out he's cool. Well, the bottom line is you don't need to be interacting with that. But if you're a mastermind and a control freak, you say, I'm going to figure out a way to make that one guy say he's not all that bad. And what ended up happening was I became so committed to the idea, which is not a reality, the idea of correction, that I completely lost sight of what the original plan was, which is you make music for anybody who wants to hear it.
It's becoming so much clearer where this record came from.
Because this
record is about you making that break from that part of your life.
And it's a very difficult break to make. And you know, maybe that's my greatest achievement, is coming so close to having the last brain cell that remembered what it was I was here for disappearing.
You are hiding in your mind, working all the time, trying to make got it. And you've been spending all your time searching for a sign that's never gonna look the way you want it. Think
now, I think the thing I love the most about where I am is that, you know, a lot of people do come around to appreciating it, but it's not there anymore. You know, a lot of people do wake up and go, wow, so when I was 23, I had a hit record, and everybody knew my name, and it was cool to want to meet me at the party, and I just put a song out, and it would do really well, and, you know, that doesn't happen to every 23-year-old. You don't see it as how lucky you were. You see it as something that you just have a touch for, and then you realize, oh, I was lucky, you know? I had to go back and, like, recode everything in my brain. Wow, okay, so I was lucky enough to figure that out and still have the opportunity to continue on in a pretty large scale. So I just take that as, like, the biggest gift of my life, is that I don't need to be any bigger than I get to be from the records that I make.
I'm speaking with the singer and songwriter John Mayer. His new record is called Born and Raised. It's interesting to hear you talk about what you've been through, because the first track of this record is about a journey. The song's called Queen of California. And, I mean, obviously it's a journey from east to west, but it's a physical journey. But this record was a journey in so many other ways for you, and it kind of sort of sets the tone right at the start of that record with that song.
That was the mission statement for the record, sort of. I think Queen of California, you always sort of write a song somewhere in the writing process for an album that becomes the den leader of the rest of the songs. The lyric, heading out west with my headphones on, makes me so happy to sing it. As a writer, that's what you try and do. You try and come up with one line that you could actually think about for, you know, 4 or 5 minutes and kind of get deep into it, you know. There's a lot to it, you know. You don't head out west with your headphones on unless you're searching for something, you know. It's actually about, you know, getting over stuff. Just being able to have a hopeful vibe about something again, which I think is why it's the first track on the record, because it's a very relieving sort of breath of fresh air.
I just found out a ghost left town. The Queen of California is a stepping down.
That's John Mayer. His new record is called Born and Raised. John, thank you so much. Get well soon, please, and congratulations on this record.
Thank you. I hope you enjoy it.
Now, you've just heard a bit of what John Mayer had to say. It was a fascinating conversation. To hear a longer version, head to our website, nprmusic.org. Now, it's time for music, and our story today is about Adam Lambert, the young man who quite literally captivated America in 2009 when he almost won American Idol.
Are you our next idol?
I think so.
Really?
Yeah.
You sure?
I can sing.
You sing? Yeah. What are you going to sing for us?
I'm going to sing I Wanna Rock With You by Michael Jackson.
Oh.
Yeah.
Good one.
Okay.
You guys ready?
We're ready.
I wanna rock with you all night, dance you in today.
Adam Lambert was brash and likable and, well, glamorous. But he soon became better known for being the first openly gay Idol contender. He didn't win, but his popularity and his talent did win him a recording deal. And this is the product of that deal.
Well, I was walking for some time when I came across this sign saying, who are you and where are you from? We don't like when visitors come.
This song is called Trespassing, and it's the title track of Adam Lambert's new record. Mr. Lambert is at our studios at NPR West. Adam Lambert, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Adam, you have turned 30 this year.
I did.
Congratulations, by the
Thank
way.
You. Thank you. I made it.
You made it? I hope there was never any doubt about that. How has it been treating you so far?
It's been good. It's been really good. You know, I think for the majority of my 20s, I was always so consumed with what I didn't have. This year, I've focused more on being thankful for what I already have, not what I've yet to find or get.
I mean, you were single-minded in your pursuit of stardom and success from an early age. I mean, long before you were on American Idol, you were doing high school musicals, and then you were doing real musicals and performing in theater in San Diego and Los Angeles. I mean, this was your focus. You were going to make it.
Yeah. And I'm a pretty intense personality. I get a lot of horsepower. And when I do get single-minded and I pour everything into one thing, you know, you can end up accidentally ignoring other things, relationships and your health.
Adam, and I want to ask you about American Idol in a moment, but anybody who saw you there, I think, would have been just blown away by your confidence. You had this command of the stage and this presence. And I wonder, did you always feel confident when you were a kid in high school musicals and when you were trying to break in? I mean, did you always feel like, this is going to happen to me and I can do this?
Not at all, actually. I struggled with confidence a lot. Huh. Even on Idol, I mean, there were a lot of moments where I felt completely insecure. I mean,
wow.
If I convinced you otherwise, that's show business. And I guess over the years, one of the things I've learned is how to put on a really good game face.
Do you think part of that struggle was also your struggle with sexuality?
Of course, yeah. That was totally wrapped up into my identity. When I was younger and, you know, in a situation like my teenage years where I really wasn't in a place where it was all that open.
You couldn't talk about it.
I wasn't talking about it. Yeah, it was, of course, that secret kind of made that very difficult. And then at about 18, at the end of like high school, when I had made peace with it and I was ready to talk about it, I did. And luckily my family was very cool and my friends were not surprised. It wasn't a big secret. And then, you know, moving to LA shortly thereafter, it was really exciting because all of a sudden I was like, oh, this is a part of my identity that I've been kind of hiding and now I can embrace it.
Your performances on that American Idol, of course, led to a recording contract. You didn't win, you were the runner-up, but still came out with a contract and you cut an album, and then now you've got this new record, Trespassing. The single you've released off, it's called Never Close Our Eyes, and this is a real kind of tribute to this kind of glam pop style of the mid-80s. I'm hearing in this song, you know, Queen, Erasure, Duran Duran, this sort of period of synth pop from the early 80s, and I'm wondering if you were trying to capture that on this record.
You know, you have your wheelhouse and you have like what makes you a performer and it just kind of naturally goes there. And I think that for me, it's easier to kind of compare me to maybe some throwback stuff because nowadays in pop, there's not a lot of men that are singing
right
big and loud and high.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as common as it once was. And then there's a couple artists that are around right now that break that rule. You know, there's someone like Bruno Mars who actually wrote Never Close Our Eyes. And he's an exception. You know, he's got this beautiful, soft, like, buttery voice. He's amazing. I'm a big fan. So I got this track from Bruno, this song, and I thought, you know, that's a great melody, great lyric. I know how I want to sing it. I want to sing it big.
You know that I wish that this night would never be over.
I'm speaking of the singer Adam Lambert. His new record is called Trespassing, and it's in stores now. The last track on the record is called Outlaws of Love, and in it you sing, "Nowhere to grow old, we're always on the run, you say we'll rot in hell. Well, I don't think we will, they've branded us enough, outlaws of love." You, of course, are gay, you're openly gay. I can't help but hear those lyrics and wonder whether you're addressing that issue or a memory of that.
Yeah, and when I wrote that song, I wrote it with two very talented people, B.C. Jean, who's a writer, and a guy named Rune Westberg, who's a great producer. And we all kind of, we started putting our thinking caps on about what we wanted to write about. There had been a lot going on with, you know, the gay marriage kind of going back and forth in California, and I was talking to them about being a member of the gay community, because neither of them are gay, and just expressing some of my frustration with the situation. And it just made me sad. And so I wanted to write something about that sadness, about that feeling where sometimes it's like a hopelessness that kind of comes over you when you look at the situation, how you're probably not going to change these people's minds because they're set.
Everywhere we go, we're looking for the sun. Nowhere to grow old.
Do you feel, because of your visibility, because you're a famous person and you're gay, that you have to make sure that you are also kind of like an inspiration to, you know, maybe younger people who are struggling with their sexuality or are worried about coming out and things like that?
I think when everything first happened and I first kind of got put on the map, there was a certain expectation of that. And at first, I was a little bit frustrated by that because I thought, you know, I'm a singer, I'm a performer, and being gay is merely a part of who I am. I've come to terms with it. It started overshadowing a lot of my musical stuff because it's all the media wants to talk about in every interview. It's what they focus on. You know, I've heard little bits of criticism from people here and there. Oh, you know, if he wants to make it in this industry, we don't care about his sexuality. Why is he always talking about being gay? It's always about his sexuality, and that's not my choice.
It's
I don't actually
agenda,
have control over that. No,
you're saying
I
mean, you're always asked about it.
I'm always asked about it. Yeah. I'm always asked about everything. I answer everything openly, and a lot of the times that part is out of my control. So at the end of the day, what's been hardest about it is that I really feel like I can't win one way or another. Either I'm not gay enough or I'm too gay, and that's been the toughest thing to try to figure out.
Tell me, Adam Lambert, what you want your fans to get from this record.
All the tracks on the album are told from kind of a first-person perspective. They're my view of the world that I live in. And I think what the listener is going to get from it is I think they're going to get to know me better. You know, it's easy to do an interview and to tell you facts and to tell you where I'm at and my opinion on things, but music really translates emotion better than words do. And I think after listening to the album, you'll understand how these things make me feel.
Well, it's a great record, and congratulations on it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That is singer Adam Lambert. His new record is called Trespassing, and it's out now. Adam, thank you so much for coming by to talk to us.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure.
For the week ending May 20th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our show was directed by Petra Mayer and Phil Harrell. Our production staff includes Brent Bachman, Walter Ray Watson, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, and Ali Dukakis. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz, and if you want to hear a longer version of that John Mayer interview, check out our website, nprmusic.org. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the program on your local public radio station. It's on in most places around 4 or 5 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. Thanks for tuning in.
Times, but try and see my heart, 'cause I need you now, so don't let me down. You're the only thing in this world I would die without. 'Cause if I wanted to die